This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 87. Today we speak with Rick Phillips about his new book, The Masculine Mandate. Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we want to thank everyone who helps to make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/support. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I have with me today a large panel. We're very excited. Our first panelist today is Nick Batzig, who's a church planter in Richmond Hill, Georgia, working out of Independent Presbyterian Church in Savannah. How are you doing, Nick?
Very well. Thanks, Camden.
We also have Jim Cassidy, who is pastor at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. It's great to have you on, Jim.
It's good to be here, Camden.
And we have Josh Walker. We haven't had him in a while, so we're pleased to welcome him back. He's at bringthebooks.org. He's a student down at RTS Jackson. It's great to have you on too, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
And our special guest today is author and senior pastor at Second Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina. We're very pleased to have to welcome back Rick Phillips. It's great to have you on, Rick.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here.
Today we're going to be speaking about Rick's new book from Reformation Trust entitled The Masculine Mandate, God's Calling to Men. It's a great book speaking about biblical anthropology and man's calling, gender roles, all sorts of great things, and we'll get to that in a minute. But do we have any news items, anything to mention before we get started today?
Well, I just wanted to mention a few upcoming Reform conferences. This will probably be coming out on Friday, so if you're in the Jacksonville, Florida area, there is a conference with Carl Truman at Ortega Presbyterian Church on October, I think, 2nd and 3rd. I believe that's a Friday and Saturday. And then Independent Presbyterian Church is having a Reformation service in Savannah, Georgia at Independent with Reverend David Hall, I guess, from Midway.
Oh, great.
Presbyterian. And then Ligonier Ministries is having their fall leadership ministry conference October 20th through 22nd down in Samford, there on the Ligonier premises. So I want to encourage you, if you're in the Georgia or Florida area, to visit some of these conferences if you have a chance. I also wanted to see if you would fill our listeners in, Camden, on what we're doing at the forum with some of the audio recording in the Calvin Project.
Sure. Well, some people might be a little confused. I did put a news update out in the feed yesterday, but what we're starting to do is we're going to be producing audio editions of various classic Reformed texts, and we're starting with Calvin's Institutes with the Henry Beveridge translation, which is in the public domain, so we're able to do that. And that is already out. It's called our program's called Reformed Classics. You can read more about it at reformedforum.org/reformedclassics. And if you're subscribed to the general Reformed Forum feed, you're going to automatically get that. I just want to let people know, because I've received some comments already, if you don't want that audio in the feed and you just want to receive Christ the Center, or you just want to receive the Reformed Media Review, whatever you want to do, if you go to reformedforum.org/subscribe, there's a whole list of all of our different feeds, and you can pick and choose what you want. So if you want everything, you can just subscribe to the main feed. But if you want to go a la carte, you can. Or if you just want to download everything and not listen to it, that's okay as well. So I want to let everyone know that we're doing that. And we're trying to expand even more in the future. So right now we're going to be producing audio versions of the Institutes. So hopefully we'll all be able to get through it this year and maybe beyond. But other than that, we're going to hopefully do some other programs in the future as well. So just want to give you a heads up and a warning in case you're wondering why we've begun reading books in the podcast feed. Well, I guess we get started. That's all I had to mention. Nick, did you have anything else?
No, I think that's it. We're sorry we can't have Jeff Waddington with us.
Yeah.
A little shout out here. We'll miss him.
We will miss him.
Hey, right. Camden, I have one more if you want, if
Please.
I can throw this one in. Yeah, there's a conference, a pastor's conference coming up in October, October 17th to the 21st at Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey. There are a couple of good speakers that will be there, including the Reverend Al Martin, who is the former pastor at that church, as well as Edward Donnelly, who
He's
is an
great.
Incredible preacher from Ireland. And I encourage you guys to take a look at the website there at Trinity Baptist Church. And I don't have a web address right at my fingertips, but if you do a Google search, you can find it quick enough. And they advertise their conference there, and it promises to be a good one, as it is every year. So check it out.
Wonderful. Well, we look
now,
forward
guys,
to all those. Yeah.
Now, this is Rick Phillips. Y'all need to go to the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals website.
Oh, yeah.
You will see that we have 6 conferences this fall, none of which Nick mentioned.
Well, Rick, the thing is, you obviously don't listen to...
in Pittsburgh. Let's see, Quakertown, Steve Lawson, Phil Reich, and Derek Thomas, November 13 to 14. Princeton is Joel Beakey and Robert Peterson on adoption. So I just wanted your listeners to be made aware of those things.
Yes,
in
thank
Nick's
you.
Defense,
we always
he has mentioned in the past the
PCRT. I do plug the PCRT.
Yeah. Well, okay, got to do that.
But thank you, Rick.
We have a whole slate of fall events with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals.
Absolutely, so there's great stuff
there.
You become
so southern, Nick.
I know, I miss the North.
Georgia and Carolina conferences.
Why don't you bring a PCRT down here to Savannah?
Philadelphia.
South Carolina, April 2010.
Yes.
All right. Well, yes, you can visit that at alliancenet.org. You can also read Reformation 21 at reformation21.org. There's all sorts of great stuff out there, and you can stay updated with those news items as well. But today we're going to be speaking about this new book from Reformation Trust. For those who don't know, it's a division of Ligonier Ministries, a great publisher. We've been very fortunate to have read several of their recent books, and today we welcome Rick onto the program to discuss his new one, The Masculine Mandate, God's Calling to Men. And I was interested to read this, one, to see how a biblical anthropology really impacts the life of the church, the life of your family, and also your personal life and your interpersonal relationships. And it's really well written. And Rick, I wanted to start, as we always start with new books, to ask you why you saw a need for this particular book. What did you see needed to be addressed basically in men's lives?
Yeah, as is usually the case with a book, there's several reasons why I wrote this book. One is I was frustrated by the poor quality, in my view, of most evangelical books on dealing with masculinity, most especially John Eldridge's mega bestseller, Wild at Heart, which is just unbiblical. I was actually having dinner with Jerry Bridges probably 3 or 4 years ago, and he lives out there in Colorado Springs, and we were lamenting this. And, and I said, Jerry, you ought to write a book on this. And we didn't have time or whatever. And meanwhile, I was asked by several conferences to speak on themes like this. There was a group in Georgia maybe 2 years ago that asked me to do a multi-day men's conference. And then Lig Duncan had me out to Jackson last year to do the Mid-South Men Rally. And so I was needing, just for ministry requests, to put together biblical material. And my own approach is always to exposit the Word. So if I'm asked to do a men's conference, I'm going to exposit the Word. And that got me dealing with these things. And also, just as a pastor, I'm well aware, this everybody is today, that we've got a real masculinity problem in the culture and in the church. I mean, it is my view that we talk about feminism and all of those problems. Look, we've got a far bigger problem with godly masculinity. In many of our churches, we'll have lots more, for instance, available, godly, marriageable women than we have their peers. We have men in the church that are just not as mature so often. And I do believe that we have a great need for biblical instruction on masculinity. Now, you start working on this stuff, and you start thinking about it, and you start becoming very impressed with the power of what the Bible says. And as I say early on in the book, we know when it comes to things like marriage or women in ministry and these sorts of things, that the New Testament directs us back to the early chapters of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're going to say, you know, what does it mean to be a man? What is my calling as a man? What am I supposed to do to be a godly man? The answer is go back and read Genesis 2. And what we'll find is a biblical teaching that is, in fact, a paradigm. What we read in Genesis 2 about God's calling to Adam as a man does, in fact, have I hate to use a word like this, but a paradigmatic influence that we will see pervading all of Scripture. And yet there's very little teaching about the masculine mandate, which is what I call Genesis 2:15.
Oh, yeah.
That there is a clear calling given to men that will be seen playing out through the book of Proverbs, playing out through biblical examples of fatherhood and husbands and Christian leadership, and that plays straight into the New Testament teaching. And I just came to the belief that there was a need for some clear biblical teaching on this. To be honest with you, it was a hard book to write because most of my books will come out of my pulpit ministry. And my working life is geared that way. I do a sermon on Sunday morning, I preach Sunday evening, I teach Wednesday night, and I don't have a lot of free time beyond that. And so this book killed me.
Yeah,
for me to write a book on the side, most of my books are biblical exposition flowing out of my pulpit ministry. And this one was a labor of love because I just felt that I had to get it done. And not that the world needs my book, but I just felt an obligation to write this book. And it was not a book that I really had time to do, but I just felt that, there's a great need for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hopeful the Lord will bless it. And I ended up, getting in about a year late, as will often be the case, because, you want to do it right. But that's why I wrote the book, out of just my own experiences, being asked to do work in it, and a profound sense that this material needs to get out there.
Absolutely.
Rick, I was actually intrigued at how you really unpacked the idea of the mandate given to Adam to dress and keep the garden, those two aspects, how they work out in the physical realm of work and whatever labor you're doing, and then in regard to your wife and your children. It very much reminded me of sort of the way John Murray goes back in Principles of Conduct and roots everything in, the creation ordinance. I had never really heard that developed as much. Were there things you were reading, or was this just from your own study of Scripture that you were really thinking about, what was the principal, what was the principal work? What made a man a man out of Genesis?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the sake of people who haven't read the not yet published book, the Genesis 2:15 says God placed Adam in the garden and charged him to work it and keep it.
That's right.
And this book is an exposition of Genesis 2:15, which mm-hmm. I'm describing as the masculine mandate. God put him in the garden to work it and keep it. You know what really got me going on this was the book Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
Because the first time I was asked to speak on this stuff, I got a copy of Wild at Heart, which I knew was this massive bestseller. And I was absolutely mortified to read the first couple of chapters. And he actually makes a statement. I have to say, I hate to admit it, I think this is how I got on Genesis 2:15. Because the premise of Wild at Heart is that man was made, the male was made out of the garden.
Mm-hmm, right
therefore,
outside.
He's undomesticated, and he finds himself. A male's life is a lifelong quest to get in touch with your masculine side. Can you imagine Ronald Reagan making a statement like this, by the way?
Well, so odd that...
No real man talks that way. I'm on a quest for my masculinity. Well, that's what life is, because Genesis 2:15 says, this is what he actually says, it's a classic example of the bizarro hermeneutics dominating us today. God placed him in the garden, therefore he belongs out of the garden.
Well, that's what they were sent after they sinned. They were sent east of Eden, and Cain as well was punished by wandering.
Because God placed him in the garden, his
right.
heart belongs outside of the garden, and the way for you to find and get in touch with your masculine self is to get out of the place where God put you. And as I put it in the book, I think we ought to think in this terms. God placed Adam in the created covenantal world with God-given relationships, duties, and obligations. And Eldred says, no, you got to go on wilderness quests, ego trips, basically, self-quest. He actually goes so far as to say that Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness was Jesus seeking his masculine identity in the wilderness. And I'm just utterly horrified. Well, I start reflecting on it, and I start saying, he is right that this verse is paradigmatic.
Yes. Mm.
But it's the exact opposite thing of what he's teaching. And I think, you know, 2 or 3 years ago when I started, I just did some men's conferences, I just said, hey, let's look at Genesis 2:15. And I'm well aware that people are reading this book. I got my first copy of Wild at Heart when an elder at my church, not this church, handed me a copy of how great this book was, and we need to buy the DVD curriculum of Wild at Heart to show all our men.
Right, right.
Will I read the book and, you know, go ballistic? But it occurs to me that he's right, that Genesis 2:15 is a very important statement, and that's what got me going down that direction.
That's very interesting. I was at a church also where they were having whole men's groups reading this book, going off on, you know, men's trips. And I remember thinking, well, what is distinctively Christian about this? I mean, it's good that, you know, we want men to be men and to be tough. And I actually expected to have more of that in your book since you're a tank commander and, you know, to have more of this emphasis on men being manly men. And that's a good emphasis and it's right. But I really liked how in the book you bring out the story of the professional dirt bike racer.
Yeah,
and at the end of, what is his name again?
Brian Deegan.
Yes.
Brian Deegan. And at
Metal
the end
Militia.
Of that, and at the end
Metal
of,
Militia, yeah.
At the end of
it's
that,
great.
You talk,
I mean, well, I'm also,
you
I'm
talk about him doing all that before he's in Christ, that
exactly.
You say, you know, he was doing all those manly things, and that's not what made him a man, but knowing God's will for him and knowing the Lord is.
And there's this great interview, and it's a couple of years ago, I'm speaking at a men's conference, and so I'm sitting in a barbershop, and I'm reading ESPN the magazine, and they have an article on Brian Deegan, this hooligan, X-game, trick bike jumper. In fact, he's like the Michael Jordan of that quasi-sport. And he has a, you know, near-death crash. He'd gotten his girlfriend pregnant, and she'd gone home to live with her parents. And meanwhile, he has this nationally televised crash that he loses half his blood. And he goes to his girlfriend's house to be medically, you know, rehabilitated. Meanwhile, she's been converted to Christ at her parents' church. He starts going to his parents' church, and he gets converted. He heals up. He comes back to the Metal Militia, starts leading a Bible study. And one by one leads most of these guys, these, you know, and this is all Nazi emblems. They were the whole package.
Mm-hmm.
He leads them all one by one to Christ. I read another interview where the typical thing's happening. Some guy's saying, you know, dude, man, you've changed. What's happened to you, Brian Deegan? You know, and Deegan says, you know what? I realize I got to become a man. Now, the last thing this guy needs to be told is that being a man is going off on ego trips.
Right.
You know, what he needs to be told is what his duty is as a husband and wife biblically, a husband and father biblically, and what biblical love is, and biblically what it means to be a covenantally faithful man.
Mm-hmm.
And all this is happening is that I'm reading all this stuff and just saying, man, I got to write a book on this.
So let's talk about that. The mandate involves two aspects, work and keep, working and keeping, as that's what man was placed in the garden to do. Could you help us to understand what you mean by work, and what is man's specific duty in working, and what is he supposed to do?
Yeah, thanks. The two in the Hebrew, it's the two verbs are avad and shamar.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple, basic Hebrew words appear hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
In the Old Testament, they're kind of, you know, building block common verbs. Avad is used in a construction context, would be to build. In a temple context, it's used of the priest serving in the temple. And in a agricultural setting, such as the Garden of Eden, it's used as farming, you know, cultivating, causing things to grow. And what we see is the man is given the mandate by God. And this is all part of the broader cultural mandate, of course. But what God calls a man to do, the first thing is that he is engaged in labor that will have the result of causing good things to grow. Now, that alone is paradigm shifting. And one thing that strikes me is in American culture, we don't think of the man as the nurturer. Biblically, he is. It is the man, I'm not saying women don't nurture, but I am saying that it is the role of a man in relationships to grow and cultivate, to engage in activity and ministry and labor that will cause others to grow.
Absolutely.
It may be to cause a business to grow. In marriage, it means that your job is to your wife's heart is the garden in which you're to have a spade, and you're to minister in that garden so that she grows spiritually. I mean, you know, as a pastor, how often do I have someone come into my office and say, you know, Pastor, I've got a lot of problems with my relationship with my mother? The answer is virtually never. I mean, that's happened once or twice, you know. But how often do I have someone come in and say, oh, I've got my relationship with my dad all the time? Why? Because the Father is the one through whose ministry we gain so much of our identity and who we are. And the cultivation of character and faith and all of those things result from the man's role. And so, we know, it's just enormously helpful for Brian Deegan to be told, hey, Brian, you want to be a man now. What you're to do, like Adam was put by God to work the garden, to engage in sacrificial ministry that would cause it to grow, well, you're to do that in all your relationships. And so the book works that out. First in principle, then in various relationships, marriage, fatherhood, church, and friendship, those kinds of things.
Yes.
The other verb is shamar, another very common word. It means to watch over and protect.
Mm-hmm.
In Psalm 121, the Lord will keep you. You know, the Lord watches over you. He neither slumbers nor sleeps. He will keep your life. That's shamar. And so Adam was placed by God into his covenantal world of relationships and duties to cause the garden to grow and to keep the garden safe. And likewise, godly men are to engage in a life of labor, the effect of which is that those under our care will be kept safe and their growth will be nurtured by our ministry. That's it. Now, isn't that beautifully simple?
It is, but it's profound as well.
And I got to stop working. I'm spending my entire life working on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Profoundly simple, but it requires the redeeming work of Jesus Christ in my life, fully expressing itself for me to do it. It is not, it's anything but easy. But I mean, to me, that is so helpfully clear, and this is what I'm to do. I'm a husband. What am I to do? My wife is to feel safe in our relationship, and I'm to make her safe and to promote her safety, and I am to engage in her ministry to her so that she grows. Now, you read Ephesians 5:22 and following, and 1 Peter 3:1-6, and that is a good summary of what the apostles teach.
Hmm.
So it's a profoundly simple but powerful paradigm.
Rick, you have a chapter in this book on shepherd leadership. I was wondering, was there any crossover between the book that you wrote, The Heart of an Executive, Lessons from the Life of David, and what you draw out in this book? I don't even know if that first book's
place.
In print. But
that chapter is largely a synopsis of that book, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, if you look at the, that's the chapter on leadership. What I do in the book is I have kind of a doctrinal half and an application half. And I work out the masculine mandate. There's an introductory chapter about man in the garden. Then there's the masculine mandate. Then I talk about men's calling to work. Look, men are to work. You know, we've become so namby-pamby in the evangelical world. I got guys telling me, oh, you know I should never be home late for dinner. You got to be kidding me. You never get anything done. Now, look, we're not to be workaholics. We're not to be my job is my idol. But dude, you got to work hard or you're going to starve.
Mm.
And my wife calls me every night to find out what time I'm going to get home for dinner, and I'm there, but I'm working hard and she knows I am. And I'm to do that, and it's a sacred thing. And then I talk about man in the image of God, and then I just have a chapter on leadership, all working out the masculine mandate. So the first half is to understand the mandate. And yes, Nick, one of the chapters is more or less a synopsis of my leadership book, yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed the various concentric circles that you marched through, speaking about how a man is supposed to relate to his wife, then to his children, then his friends, and also to the church. But also speaking about work, when you go out even beyond that, beyond the church, people nowadays have various views about vocation. And the Reformed have a very specific view about vocation, and it's actually quite liberating in my opinion. But I wanted to ask you, what is right work? I think that's the way you put it in the book. At least outside of the home, we know the kinds of things we're supposed to do with our wives and with our children and in the church. What is acceptable, and how should man go about his work out in the secular sphere, we might say?
Yeah, here's the third chapter of the book is Man's Sacred Calling to Work, and I just deal with man's general calling to labor and how that is holy and it is good. And you know, I point out that all our hobbies are work. You know, what do you like to do? I do woodworking. Well, that's like working with wood. We were made to work. Heaven is going to involve work. Praise the Lord. You know, what are the rewards given in the parable of the talents? You will enter, you know, enter into my labor. You know, you were faithful with little, you will be made faithful. You will be given charge over much.
It's not retirement.
So we're workers. Now, that being said, therefore, a Christian man is to use his life working in keeping. And we're to engage in our lives in ways that, yes, provide for our family and actually do something that's good. And so I do think that there are some kinds of occupation that are going to be more appropriate than others. I have something of a pet peeve, as we'll come across, I suppose, about things like day trading. Now, here's a guy whose work is sitting in front of a computer, skimming money off the market, making money off of speculating effectively off of other people's productivity. What is this guy contributing to the world? And I just don't see that biblically. And I use that as a very negative example, but you know, that I think that's a biblical way of thinking. When I was in South Florida, the big phenomenon there was house flipping, which of course had played a huge role in the collapse of our economy. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of guys in my church who were really, really into this. And I called them in and I said, you know, I mean, is this godly? That your passions and all your planning is that you're going to try and make a quick buck off of basically real estate speculation? And is it wise? And those guys, of course, I've since learned, got creamed. That's just not the way God designed it. We're to work hard producing things of value to our fellow human beings and that give glory to God from which we gain compensation to provide for our families. Now, that gives a whole gamut of things, right? And again, it's the Reformed doctrine of vocation that I think is so liberating. But it also needs to, it's not just, you know, I'm making money. I'm engaging in good work that glorifies God and that actually accomplishes things worthwhile for others.
Hey, Rick, I have a question. I'd like to – we touched on it a little bit earlier, so it's sort of piggybacking off of some earlier comments. You got this very simple line in your book that jumped out at me where it says you were talking about things that you thought were manly but really weren't. And that struck me because and here within the Reformed Church, we're not innocent. In this regard, we have come up with conceptions of what is manly, usually quoting Christian liberty as the excuse for our manliness. What are some of those things perhaps that you have learned, that you have seen as a pastor, that you can help us with, direct us on what is unbiblical manliness relevant?
I would say in general, you know, self-glorifying bravado is not manly. I use the example of the book. I mean, I was raised in a cavalry family. My father was a cavalry officer. I was a cavalry officer. My grandfather commanded the Army's last horse cavalry regiment in 1938, and we finally traded in our horses for tanks. And so, like, I was raised around a lot of cav motif. And you know, one of my favorite movies as a pagan young man was John Wayne Scheer, War Yellow Ribbon. A classic. And in that, you know, the throwaway line of John Wayne, too, as he's raising his lieutenants and whipping these young guys into shape, was, "Mister, never apologize."
Yeah, right.
And that was his thing. Never apologize. So, you know, when I was a 21-year-old tank lieutenant, I said, hey, I want to be a real man. I'm never going to apologize. I was just being an egotistical jerk. And that's kind of a simple way of just pointing out all that bravado, self-serving, you know, so much of what's going on today, I think, among young adult men in their 20s and even 30s, and I see it among Christian young adult men, is that we're going to perpetuate being a boy as long as we can. And I'm going to lead a life of me playing games. I mean, just the amount of time going to video games.
Absolutely.
Rather than marriage is shocking. and unwholesome, and we need to embrace the biblical calling that, look, we are to enter into covenantal relationships, husbands, fathers, church members, in which we fulfill the masculine mandate of working and keeping. And that's what we're to be doing with our lives, and that's what's good, and that's what's wholesome. What we've got is this pseudo-masculinity of, I'm going to be a self-centered adolescent as long as I possibly can. And we've got a whole Christian industry of men's Bible studies and whatnot perpetuating this. I'm not against men's Bible studies, don't get me wrong. But guys need to get married. And if they say, well, you know, I'm not ready, well, then get ready. Why? I mean, really, no, I mean that.
Yeah.
I'm 30, and look, this is not a, I'm generalizing, so I'm not meaning to condemn every single 35-year-old guy, many of whom, and I talk about this in the book, many of whom desire to work, to be married, and for whatever reason, so I'm not trying to condemn at all, but we do have to speak in generalizations, and there's a broad trend going on today that needs to be confronted, and that is that Christian men need to grow up, they need to embrace biblical manhood, and that is going to lead to marriage and fatherhood.
Absolutely.
In the vast majority of cases. And I think today, now in terms of, you know, Christian liberty and all this, well, it's true. I mean, I think it's in part because so many people are coming out of legalism and fundamentalistic legalism into the Reformed faith that, you know, the real sign that you're really Reformed is you get a little drunk now and again. I actually had a young woman say to me within the last year, you know, I've really been persuaded of the Reformed faith, but do I have to get drunk?
Oh, man.
Wow.
And I said, you know, you don't have to.
Oh, wow.
You're supposed to. No, I didn't say that at all. And so we've got, again, it's another adolescent response rather than a biblical view of Christian liberty, which you are free to do many things, but it's not in a self-serving, self-aggrandizing way. The orientation is one of ministry and giving glory to God.
Amen.
And I want to conduct myself in a way that's going to be edifying to others, and it's going to preserve them from error. I'm going to work and keep. I'm going to build and protect. This is my grid on masculinity. And I just think it's very powerful. And, yeah, we have a great need. But I want to say this. You know, we have so many guys who they don't have role models. And just the whole fatherhood issue in America. And so I'm not trying to condemn people at all. And here we have the Bible, which gives this really clear, simple, and powerful paradigm. So I'm hoping it'll help people.
Picking back up on the working and keeping from Genesis 2:15, that was given to Adam before the fall. How has the fall into sin affected our masculine mandate?
Yeah, great. I mean, it's very interesting that one of the things to understand about the fall is the fall corrupts pre-existing good. That's true with both the man and the woman. And the first chapter, the second half of the book is, you know, the application. I have three chapters on marriage, two chapters on fatherhood, then I do friendship and the church, and then I have a wrap-up chapter. The first chapter on marriage is just looking at creation, fall, redemption of marriage. And so with the woman, for instance, God made the woman with a manward focus. She's a suitable helper for him. And so what does sin do to that? It turns being a suitable helper, she's made to orient to the man and be his companion helper, and now she becomes his controller.
Yeah.
And so you have Genesis, 3:18?
Yeah, her desire will be for her husband.
She will desire to control him, and she's obsessed with him. Check out. And I say, you know, go look at the woman's magazine rack, and every article is about possessing and controlling a man.
Yep.
That's how sin has affected women. Well, likewise, God made Adam, God made the male to be the lord of the garden, little L lord, God's regent in the garden to work it and keep it. So man has a outward focus, not inward towards the relationship per se, but outward towards the world, and sin perverts that. And so now by the sweat of your brow will you eat your bread. And on the one hand, we have to work hard. We have to work a little too hard. And, you know, I mean, it's true, but we live in a fallen world. And so men have to work really hard. But also, man makes an idol of it. Let's go to the men's magazine section. What's it about?
Right.
stuff out in there, the creation become idols, sports obsessions, cars, trucks, guns, oh, women, but not as companions, not as ministry sources, but women as objects of my self-centered gratification. And so the fall has corrupted the good orientation that God gave man towards the cultural mandate and the creation. And that's what we have today. And so what I have in marital conflict as a pastor when I'm doing marital counseling, every single couple who ever comes to see me brings one variant or another on the curses of the fall corrupting them. The woman's controlling him, nagging him, the man's neglecting her, and all he wants to be out with the boys, he wants to be out working on his truck, he wants to be climbing the next rung on the ladder of his career, all this external idolatry. I mean, really, masculine sins, there's always lust, pride, some idolatrous infatuation with the world outside of him. And the feminine is a sinful obsession about the relationship, and feminine sins are all anxiety. Not all, but they tend to be. Fear, anxiety, resentment, bitterness, that kind of thing. And so this is what sin has done. It has corrupted the design that God made so wonderfully. Now, redemption, then, is going to remedy that. And so I think it's just very helpful to have a biblical grid on creation, fall, and redemption of the marriage relationship and of gender.
Rick, there seems to be a lot of confusion in our day about the legitimacy of self-defense, defending your family, defending loved ones, defending your country. I know you didn't write this book per se to deal with those issues, but could you talk to us briefly about what you understand the biblical teaching on that to be with regard to us being godly men and the responsibility or right or privilege or whatever there is to defend those that God has put in our care?
Well, the book does not deal with those directly, but certainly what the book says will deal with that. We are to be those who safeguard good things. We are to, to work and to keep. So the keeping side is being a guardian protector. We are to be guardians of the truth, right? We are to be guardians of true things. We are to be guardians of our children. Look, what would happen if I'm out in the street and my next door neighbor starts punching out my son? What's my duty as a man? My duty is to get in there and start wailing on the person. I am to defend. I had a thing about 2 years ago with my oldest son, who's a great kid. We are so blessed by all our children. But I have two boys and three girls. I have an older boy who's an older brother, and he's typical that way. And sometimes he doesn't want his younger brother around. And we had a thing in the neighborhood where the two of them were playing with a group of boys, and an older boy picked on my younger son.
Yeah.
And struck him. How do I know this? Because my younger son came running out of the house. He was like 7 at the time, crying. And, I said, what's wrong? And so hit me over the head with a plastic gun. He had a big welt on his head. And I asked the question, where was your brother?
Mm.
Well, he was there. So I go walking across the street to the backyard where all the boys were playing. And there's my older son playing with the boy, laughing it up with a boy who beat up his little brother. And I said, and they all saw me like, uh-oh. And I said, I don't want to talk to any of you but my son, and you will come here. And we talked, and what he said to me? I said, why did you not defend your little brother? What did he say? Because I'm a Christian. That's what he told me. Because I'm a Christian, turn the other cheek, which is not what he was doing. He was sinfully laughing it up with him. And I said, let me tell you, son, what would you feel if you and I were standing here? And our next door neighbor has struck you, and then you came out and saw me standing laughing within a half hour later.
Mm.
I wouldn't feel very good, Daddy. No, and it would never happen, because I would defend you, because you are covenantally placed under my care. And do you not feel that you should be able to look to me for your safety because I'm your father? Yes, I do. Now let's talk about your younger brother. And I said, son, next time that happens, I expect you to have blood on your knuckles.
Well,
awesome.
But this is the reason.
This is not machismo, and I'm not
promoting
machismo. And that young man's a fine young man. But tell me that's not true.
The reason I asked the question, Rick, is because that's such a rare answer in our society. In the church, turn the other cheek is applied almost instantly to every single occasion and situation. And, while we're not living under the old covenant and under the typical economy and the civil laws, it is obvious that that wasn't the case.
No, but we would want to just make clear to our listeners that you would want to use as little force as necessary
to
get the job done.
We're to defend.
To defend, not to be egregious about it. But if it takes blood on the knuckles, it takes blood on the knuckles.
Turning the other cheek is about vengeance against sins against you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's what the Lord is doing. You know, the same God who gave us the "Thou shalt not murder" mandated killing. In fact, at the same time, it's in the time of Moses, the same covenantal context in which we are told "Thou shalt not murder," and that is what the Sixth Commandment says. It does not say "Thou shalt not kill."
That's right.
There's a whole number of Hebrew verbs dealing with killing, and that one means murder. That same covenantal documents, you know, the Pentateuch, stipulates all kinds of cases in which people are to be judicially or covenantally put to death. And so let's just handle the Bible honestly. And I'm not promoting machismo. Let's go up there and beat people up. I'm just saying that it is a man's obligation to keep safe those whom God has covenantally placed under his care.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to involve physical defense sometimes. And when I was first converted, I was a combat officer, and I was a 30-year-old Army captain, and I had all kinds of Christians telling me I had to leave the Army, and it just made no sense to me. I said, honestly, are you telling me that if you and I are walking down the street leaving church and some guy rapes you, I'm just standing there and watching it happen?
Oh.
We're just reacting against it. So, you know, we do so much of our theology in reaction, and we got to stop reacting against things. And so, yes, a part of a man's calling is that he would keep safe those under his care. Yeah.
Well, speaking of those under your care, I wanted to ask you about the role of this understanding of biblical masculinity as it applies to office. Particularly, we might consider eldership and then the diaconate. What can we learn about biblical masculinity, and how should that inform our roles as officers? Many of our listeners are elders or deacons or pastors. How might they, what can they take and learn from being a man and apply that
to?
Actually,
I didn't really give much attention to, you know, can women be officers in the book? It's not what I'm doing.
Well, we're assuming, I think you've been very clear on your position on that.
I have been very clear my position on that.
And God is
well,
too.
Well, let's go at it at another angle. What is biblical?
No, but I do actually state that in the book. But I, the paradigm's very helpful. I'm an elder. What am I to do as an elder? I'm to rule and shepherd, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm to oversee the doctrine and the affairs of the church to make sure that it's biblical and right. And I'm to spiritually take care of the people in the church. Right before you guys called me, my assistant minister was in here, and we were talking about a case with a single woman in our church who was converted after a life of a lot of sin. And she's an adult, never married. She's got two teenage boys from different fathers. And, you know, and we were just talking about, you know, our elders and trying to put together a pastoral process to guide her and shepherd her and nurture her and her children towards godliness in the home in the setting they have, you know. And so elders are to guard the church, and together they are to nurture the church.
Yeah,
they are to spiritually build it up.
Work and
keep.
So
the working keeping paradigm this is not some shtick that I developed.
Right.
This is the paradigmatic mandate of Genesis 2 for men.
And it is for men. That's important. And so
yeah,
we can make a case
so.
For male officers because the officers do that which men are commanded to do. It's part of their mandate.
And, of course, that is given to Adam before the woman is made.
Yes.
And she is made to help to be a helper to him. And so you have the masculine mandate, and then the woman is given the gender part is relevant and is distinctive to what's going on. It's not just mankind. It is the male.
Yeah. So how might this affect the current controversy in the PCA on deaconesses? Can we apply this masculine mandate to the office of deacon, or is that too much of a stretch? Should you go about the case in another?
I want to say that I think that what's really going on is not about whether or not we can have installed deaconesses. And if I sincerely believe that all this was a desire to give women opportunities to serve in the church, I would not be very exercised over it.
Right.
And I am not up in arms about people who do things differently than I do. We do not have deaconesses in our church, and we're not going to. Not just because of me. The church is not going to do that. But other people are, 10th Pres, where I used to come from, and Nick was the guy there. They don't ordain their deacons, the women. They right. have female deaconesses working alongside the ordained male officer deacons. It may not be what I would do, but I can respect it, and I don't have an axe to grind against it. But I think what's really going on today is that the church is capitulating on a lot of issues. It's postmodernity is blowing across the church today. And what the culture is saying is, don't have distinctions.
Exactly.
Don't have categories.
They're blurring the lines.
Don't have rules. And
roles.
It's my opinion that a lot of our brothers that with a sincere desire to reach people for Christ find it hard to stand with strong tension against a lot of these things because we look like a bunch of fundamentalists, you know, that kind of thing. And they won't listen to our gospel preaching. You see, I think actually what's greatly needed by our culture and what our witness to the world, the best way for us to love the world today is to promote biblical distinctions and biblical definitions and biblical callings to teach them and to live them out with great clarity. And you know, we're a downtown church, and I get a lot of young people coming to our church. They are craving biblical order for their lives. And the last people who would push me back over biblical complementarianism in our church are our young women. I mean, we get couples in their early 20s joining our church, and the women are craving. Well, the one thing they're craving is a husband who embraces the biblical model of manhood. Because no woman is going to complain that her husband is devoting himself to her safety and her growth. The problem that women have today is that their husbands are self-serving
yes.
adolescents who are neglecting their growth.
Right.
And who are emotionally distant from them and who are playing their games or pursuing their guy idols. And so I think at the very moment where we need a strong witness, not actually, I don't like the terms patriarchy. And I think there's this knee-jerk right. patriarchy stuff that I think is not biblical.
Right.
And it's a reaction. And I'm a little freaked out by a lot of this patriarchy stuff, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But biblical manhood is another matter.
Yeah, and two of the titles you use, servant disciple and Lord Shepherd, built into them carry certain types of imagery. And when also you already mentioned earlier, when we read Romans chapter 5 or Ephesians chapter 5, you start to see what the man is called to do. That with the authority, the rightful authority he has, comes great responsibility. And just as Christ came to serve and to care for his sheep, the men are supposed to care for those who are under his authority and under his care. And when he does that appropriately, then the women do not have cause for complaining. Yeah. What we have in the problem with this patriarchal society, as you say, is men are not doing their jobs.
Well, and a high percentage, at least, of our women problems are frustration over men. I mean, honestly, women are sinners and they're feminine sins, but we have a far bigger problem with men neglecting their calling than we do with women. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's true in society. When I lived in Philadelphia, we lived next door to a couple of lesbians once. And one was in her 60s and one was in her 50s. And we knew them pretty well, and they were very pleasant. And one day I was out front with our kids, and some guy rides by on a bike, and these two lesbians, I hear them whistling and talking about how attractive this man is. And I know them well enough to say, what? You're lesbians. What are you doing? Commenting on the sexuality of a man. Well, they said, we're not attracted to women. We are so tired of the abuse that our fathers and first husbands
oh my
and
goodness.
Brothers gave us that we've just given up on men. And I thought, wow. And I think that is in ways lesser and greater that's happening with women in our society, is they're just tired of being taken advantage of and taken for granted and or abused. And no, the record of any problem with women embracing what I write in this book. You know, my wife and I did a book. This is a book is similar to the book that my wife and I did called Holding Hands, Holding Hearts, a biblical view of dating. And again, the approach is, let's find out what the Bible says and let's apply it. And when we in those, my wife and I will do seminars now and again on biblical dating and how men and women are to relate in dating. And when I talk about in a setting with singles, when I say, now look, what the man's to do is he's to cherish her and he's to nurture her heart. And what you need to do as men is you need to get to know them and you need to minister to them for their spiritual growth. When I say that, the women, and these are educated corporate women, they don't call me sexist. They fall out of their chairs and say they would die
yes.
to be treated that way by a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I think that the issue with the, you know, the things, the battles in the PCA today, are, my concern is at the very moment when we need clarity in biblical gender teaching and practice, we're saying, oh, it's all messy and it's ambiguous and, you know, we don't want to sharply distinguish between men and women. I think it's pastorally, it's a disaster.
Mm.
At the very, what we need, the Bible is good. And people who would disagree with me on female deaconesses, I'm not saying they're against the Bible. I just want to say, what the Bible teaches, and I do believe the Bible does teach gender distinctions in office, and I am completely unpersuaded by the biblical arguments being made in favor of deaconesses, and I think that they are gratuitous and convenient. You know, the Bible is very clear. You know, 1 Timothy 3, let him be the husband of one wife. Folks, this is not a woman. It's a male. But I think what's happening, though, is we're feeling the pressure of society to conform. And we have a desire to reach them with Jesus. And we don't want to argue over cultural issues. And so we want to get a hearing. And so we're feeling pressure not to look like a bunch of fundies. And so we want to look hip and all that kind of stuff. But see, I think, no, actually, what the world needs from us is biblical clarity in teaching and practice. Because what the Bible teaches is good and wholesome, and it brings life. And here we have, when it comes to masculinity, very clear teaching that is revolutionary and will bring, I pray it will bring life to men and their families.
Rick, I for one am planning on actually starting a men's group here for New Covenant for our church plant in the near future, and hopefully going to use this book because I really think it's an outstanding book to introduce this subject to men in our churches. Do you have any other advice for us who are pastors? Jim and I are pastors. Camden will be soon, Lord willing. Do you have any other advice on how we can approach discipling men in the church, just practical points for pastors that are listening?
Yeah, I'll give you a practical one. Every church I've ever been to, I started a men's Bible study that I personally led. And God has always blessed that. And it's always at some awful, inconvenient time. You know, in Florida, it was 8 o'clock on Saturday mornings. Here, it's 6:30 on Fridays. In fact, I've not been attending recently. We've got a professor at Greenville Seminary who's a member of my church, and he leads it now because I was physically wearing out. But everywhere I've gone, I started a men's Bible study that I personally lead because men will come if the senior minister's doing it. That's the way it is. Hmm. Where I will study the Bible with them. We did 1 Kings, which is a great book on manhood issues and godliness. And it doesn't really, we can do practically any book of the Bible. But what I found is that we need male leadership in our church, and I need to be doing something. While look, most of my ministry is my ministry of the word, preparing for my sermons, and all my other teaching, my general pastoral ministry, my ministry of prayer. So I've got this general word-centered, word and prayer-centered ministry going on. So I don't have a lot of time to be doing men's programs. I'm visiting people in the hospital. I'm a pastor. But one thing I can do is I can start a men's Bible study that I personally lead, and the men who come to that, and men will come, out of that, I have found that's where my deacons and elders come from, frankly. And
thank you.
Just build up a core of men who've been studying the Bible together. And it may be at a certain point you can back off a little bit, as I've recently needed to do here, and I have some strong other men who can lead it, but I'm involved with it. But I do think that my church does not have a men's program. Not that I'm against it. We have a men's Bible study that the men come to. The problem with so many men's programs is they're so unmanly. You know, I mean, men are not, I don't say this in the book, but, you know, men are not supposed to sit around looking into the mirror thinking about themselves. It's not manly. You know, men, I mean, here's a men's group, one of the best men's groups in my church is called The Session.
Yeah.
Another is Diaconess.
That's great.
And men are to work and keep, not to sit around thinking about manhood. Now, we need biblical teaching on manhood. But, you know, right. Generally speaking, if you have a men's group, don't, okay, maybe, look, do my book. I mean, we do need some biblical teaching on it. But then study Galatians.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I'm doing a men's retreat in a few weeks for another PCA church, and I'm really glad to give some solid biblical men's teaching to them. Men do not grow by looking at their navels. Men grow by working and keeping, frankly.
That's right.
And so we want to call men into the work of the church. You know, I have a chapter about the church.
Yes.
And, you know, while there are some who are called and equipped and qualified to be elders and deacons, it is the calling of all men in the church to be involved in the working and keeping of the church.
Well, we can all agree with that, and that's something everybody should listen and take heed to. Well, Rick, we want to thank you for joining us. The book is The Masculine Mandate, God's Calling to Men, available from Reformation Trust. Thanks for writing this, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks, guys, and God bless you all. I appreciate it very much.
I want to let everyone know you can visit us at reformedforum.org and you get a list and get news updates on everything we're doing, Christ the Center, the Reformed Media Review, and most recently, Reformed Classics. You can read and listen, and hopefully you can grow as well, and we can fulfill part of our masculine mandate in producing these materials for you. So if you need to get a hold of us, you can mail us at mail@reformedforum.org or visit reformedforum.org/contact. I want to thank everybody for listening. We look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.